This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. My guest this week is Sister Simone Campbell, who's the executive director of the Catholic Social Justice Lobby Network, which helps people in poverty. She's on the show courtesy of the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice right here in Madison, Wisconsin. You may know Sister Simone as one of the nuns on the bus. Sister Simone, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Glad to be with you.
You know, it's a pleasure to meet you. I've seen you on TV, and I was really impressed by you and by the whole Nuns on the Bus tour. So I made a note that if I ever got a chance to meet you, I'd want to drag you in front of this microphone. So here you are.
Well, glad to be here.
You know, I always like to get to know the guest on the show, and I think for the person listening in her car or in his kitchen, that she and he would want to know a little bit about you, too. So did you always want to be a nun?
No, actually, I wanted to be a doctor, but that was after I wanted to be a firefighter. That was the first thing, but it was because I liked Dalmatians, but thought the dogs were really great. But then early on, I decided I wanted to be a doctor because I liked science and I wanted to help people. And then it just kind of morphed after that into I got real active in civil rights, and that led me to wanting to be involved in my religious community is dedicated to social work and making social change. So,
what were you doing in the civil rights movement?
Oh, I was a young kid, and we were doing sit-ins at the Board of Education in Los Angeles. And my sister and I were really followed Dr. King, and you know, read things and saw when we were young, seeing kids having to be escorted to school by the National Guard because they weren't let in, and just because of the color of their skin, we couldn't understand it. And so it really shaped me as a youth. And
were your parents politically active? Or?
Well, not exactly. My grandfather, looking back, my grandfather was very politically active in Colorado. My folks were from Colorado. And so an early memory for me as a child is helping him assemble the legals. He had a print shop, and he printed the laws for the county and Adams County. And so we helped him assemble the legals around the table. And I have a child's eye view of the edge of the table. And me, since I was older than my sister, I was tall enough to do it, and I could help my grandfather. So that was probably some political orientation to get started. But my folks, not really hugely political. In 1960, when I was young, when I was in grammar school, the Democratic Convention was in L.A., and they took us up to – we were Kennedy girls. Mm. And so we were all excited about Kennedy and took us up to the acceptance speech at the Coliseum. So I still have the ticket from that as a little memento.
It's, yeah, that might be worth something on eBay.
Oh, that's I hadn't even thought about that. If
no,
I get,
you don't want to peddle it.
Oh, no. It means too much to my heart.
So. Yeah, I'm sure. A lot of Catholic families, big Kennedy supporters.
Absolutely.
When he was running. That was huge. And it's interesting just to remember back at his famous speech where he was talking about separation of church and state and how far we've come from that. Now, you became a lawyer too. In what order did you do all this?
Oh, sure. Well, I joined the community my freshman year of college, and then it's a 3-year orientation program, and then I took first vows and graduated from college 2 years after that, and then I went and did a variety of things, social work things up in Oregon. And while I was doing community organizing, I realized, I don't know enough. If we were doing tenants' rights legislation work, and I had good testimony, good stories, touch your heart, but I also needed to understand the law. And I hate power imbalance. Mm-hmm. So I realized I needed to go to law school. And then after I took final vows in the community, then I went to UC Davis, the University of California at Davis, to law school.
You know, you say you hate power imbalance. It's interesting to me because I think at the heart of almost every progressive value at its core, and maybe every moral code, is the revulsion at bullies.
Ooh, interesting. You know, I hadn't thought of it that way, but it really is about that we all need to be able to use our voice and to be engaged and have our dignity respected and respect each other's dignity in the process. So that to me then becomes that, then knowledge becomes the way forward, how we can free ourselves to be engaged in serious dialogue.
So, you know, a tenants' rights lawyer who became a poet, and you became a poet, so I want to ask you about becoming a poet too. A friend of mine, Martina Spada, wrote great poems about being a tenant lawyer and how frustrating it was for him to see this power imbalance in the courtroom and in the whole judicial system. But yeah, tell me about your poetry.
Oh, the poetry. Well, I've only been a poet since like 2001. And I had sabbatical and I was couldn't afford to be a photographer. That was actually what I thought I would do. But I took this vow of poverty, so I don't have any money. So, but I did have paper and ink. And someone once had said, oh, you've got such a poetic imagination. I thought, well, maybe I could try this. And it actually became this really gift of trying to express the inside connections or to see the surprising connections that exist in our world or to, when my heart's broken and are excited, it's a way of trying to express that.
So you're still writing poetry?
I am still writing poetry periodically, though Barbara Kingsolver says that you can never claim to be a poet. Its poems are given, and if you don't pay attention to them, they roll under the couch like a dust bunny. Mm. So I try to pay attention to the poems.
Paying attention is a huge part of being a poet. We ran a poem by Mary Oliver, and she talks a lot about paying attention, of
course,
to the natural world in her poetry. It's beautiful. What poets do you like?
Oh, I love Mary Oliver. In fact, I just used one of her poems yesterday at a lead, all about, I tell you this to break your heart, then break open to the rest of the world and never close again. It's just fabulous.
And being open to astonishment, too, is just another part
absolutely, of it. Absolutely. Gerard Manley Hopkins, I love the sound. The sound is just, and his images are so, who else? Oh, and then some of the, like Walt Whitman, to see the whole sense of grass. It's the vast expanse of beauty in nature. So there's a whole bunch.
And it's so freeing to read Whitman, too, because he's just so exuberant, you know.
Exactly. Not at all repressed.
No, hardly. My guest this week is Sister Simone Campbell, who's the executive director of the Catholic Social Justice Lobby Network. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Well, let's push forward and get to the bus tour, Nuns on the Bus. How'd you come up with that idea, or were you not the person who came up with it?
Well, actually, the miracle of the Nuns on the Bus is that nobody knows who first said road trip in this meeting we had on May 14th last year. I had just asked for help to how to respond. We had a lot of notoriety because we had been named by the Vatican as being suspect and supporting radical feminist themes. So I asked colleagues in Washington, D.C. to help us figure out how we can use this moment for mission, because it was never about us as Catholic sisters. It's always about our mission. And when we got together for an hour and a half meeting in our office, by the end of it, I knew we were going on the bus. And I had a map in my head, and I knew what we were going to stay in mother houses and go to Catholic sisters' works and lobby members of Congress, and we were going on a wrapped bus, and I had no idea what a wrapped bus was, but everybody said it was a good idea. So it came out of that meeting, and then I said we needed new money. We couldn't do, because money had been really tight for us in the recession. It's been so hard because we depend on contributions. And so what happened was within 10 days, I had the $150,000 that we needed to make this happen.
You had put a call out, or what happened?
Well, I mean, people who were at the meeting began sharing the news, and it was like, it was electric. And then it was like, oh my heavens, we got the money. 10 days. Oh my heavens, now we have to do it. And so we had the idea on May 14th, had the money by May 25th, and we were on the road June 17th. It was like grease lightning.
And how many places did you visit?
32 stops, 9 states, 2,700 miles, 15 days. It was
And
amazing.
Part of what you were doing was challenging Paul Ryan's savage budget. Did you ever encounter Paul Ryan?
Not on the bus. We went to Janesville, just down the road here. That was our second full day of being on the bus, and that was when I knew that the thing had exploded, because we had like 350 people there supporting us. I had thought going to Janesville, we wouldn't have any supporters. It would just be us, and we'd go meet with his staff, Ryan's staff. But we had this tremendous turnout. And then had a very nice meeting with the staff, but we had all this press too. I did a CNN stand-up there. They cut live to Janesville. I mean, it was like amazing. So it was really this great opportunity. But then I finally did get to meet with Congressman Ryan when we got in July 15th, when we got back to D.C.
What was
we
that did, like?
It was very hard, because I was trying to connect with him about what the people we'd met and the stories we'd heard and what his budget would do to all the people we met on the bus trip. And he kept saying, they're not the target. They're not the target of this budget. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, scored it really well. They scored it really well. And he kept handing me paper. And I kept trying to talk to him about people. And I realized that we were just missing each other. So I was trying to establish a personal connection with him. He always talks about how he sleeps in his office and his family stays in Janesville. Well, I don't think that's healthy for anybody. So I said to him something to the effect of, well, is that good for you or your family? That doesn't seem healthy. How's that going? Is it all right? He couldn't.
He didn't want to go there.
That was too much. So I'm hoping maybe I can have another visit.
Sounds like he's all from the neck up, though. You know, a lot of people in politics, they don't feel. They just kind of think and are on one side or on the other, and they just don't relate.
That there's more of a doctrinaire kind of approach to it. That's why I kept inviting the presidential candidates and vice presidential candidates to come meet my people, because I thought if they met my people, they'd their hearts would be touched.
And did anyone take you up on that?
No. I kept trying. We had a bunch of different venues. One was in Cincinnati that was just really touching in October, and had some of the people we'd met on the bus in different stops. I brought them to Cincinnati and invited the candidates to come. Well, as close as we got was we had some staffers, but that was at least a step.
I'm speaking with Sister Simone Campbell of the Catholic Social Justice Lobby Network. She was intimately involved with the Nuns on the Bus tour. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. I want to go back a little bit, because you prefaced your answer to the Nuns on the Bus question with this acknowledgement that you'd been reprimanded by the Vatican. What was that like?
Well, it was a shock, for one thing, because the Vatican has never talked to us. And then the other thing to realize is that network's small. I mean, at the time, we only had 9 full-time staff. Now we have 10. But, I mean, 9 full-time staff in Washington, D.C. makes the Vatican nervous? It was, like, shocking. But I very quickly knew that the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, which was really the target of the criticism, had to be careful in their dealing with the media, because they're directly created by Rome. And our organization has no direct tie to Rome, so that I could be a public face and to use the moment to try to speak out as a Catholic sister and respond to press inquiries.
But the Pope could still reach out and excommunicate you if you wanted to.
Yes, that's true. Or, there are things that could be done, but nothing directly to network.
I want you to react to the criticism. It was not only promoting radical feminism, which I'd be eager to hear your response to, but also scolding you for working too much on poverty and economic justice and not enough on abortion or same-sex marriage.
I know.
That just seems unbelievable to me, given all the emphasis in the New Testament and in Jesus' life about, you know, combating poverty and helping the neediest.
Exactly. And the fact is, we were founded in direct response to the Bishop's Synod on Economic Justice, where they urged people to become engaged in systemic change for economic justice. So that's their mission of our organization. So in a way, to have our mission so affirmed that we were doing it too well, I mean, it was a badge of honor, quite frankly, to lift it up. It was fabulous.
But, you know, Rome has traveled so far, quite a distance from Vatican II.
True.
What hope do you have that it'll come back?
Well, I think we're at a real change point, obviously, right now with Pope Benedict's resignation, which I think surprised the whole world.
Yeah, what was your reaction to that?
Oh, I was totally shocked. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. I was got to the airport and saw it on the screen at the airport. So that was a shock. But so that there's a real time of transition, I think, within the institutional church. But one of the things about faith is way deeper than the institution. And the institution, the structure, the hierarchy, the leadership can cause a lot of pain and hurt. But I think of it as like a ship on the sea. They're the ship. They're on the sea. They're trying to navigate it. But that really, when you get into faith, it's down deep. It's way deeper than that. So hopefully there will be a renewal, a resurgence. The Holy Spirit is alive and well and making mischief. And Nuns on the Bus would have never happened if we hadn't had the censure. Hmm. So good things come out of hard stuff. So.
But when the censure happened, you didn't consider leaving the church or leaving the sisterhood?
Oh, no, no. I mean, the fact is, my faith is so much more than that. And, you know, the other piece is Jesus did say that if you try to work for justice, you're going to have a hard time. Hmm. I just didn't expect it from within the church. So. Mm-hmm. But faith is deeper than this. It's shaped my spiritual life, which is the my biggest treasure. Mm-hmm. So,
and have you ever had your faith either shattered or deeply upset?
Disturbed.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, of course. Of course. Because faith is just that. I mean, a piece of faith is doubt. And so if you don't embrace both, then it's not really faith. You've either got certainty or you've got total denial. But the fact is that in the hard times, I think of it as being in the dark. And in the dark, when you're faithful, I move more slowly. I seek others. There's an intimacy in the dark, and others can lead me out. Mm. So that's when community is so important.
Your community is really important, whether you're a person of faith or not, or just a progressive person who
absolutely
appreciates the sustenance that community can provide. And here in Madison, Wisconsin, we've got a great longstanding progressive community and community friends that provide that kind of sustenance. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor of the Progressive Magazine that's always been in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm speaking with Sister Simone Campbell of Network. Tell me a little bit more about Network and the work you do there.
Well, we're 40 years old and almost 41. And we were founded, as I said, to do economic justice and to lift up the needs of those at the margins of our society. And over the years, we've worked on one of our biggest accomplishments with healthcare reform, the Affordable Care Act.
You are a supporter of that.
Absolutely. We're a supporter of it. And I wrote what's called the Nuns Letter, which is the real reason the Vatican censured us, was because I wrote the Nuns Letter.
And what was in that letter?
And the letter said that we supported the passage of the Affordable Care Act in the House of Representatives and were credited. I got 59 of the leaders of Catholic sisters' orders to sign the letter, and 26 Democrats told me that they voted for the Affordable Care Act because of it. And therefore, the president told me we were the tipping point, and he gave me a kiss on the cheek.
Oh, when did you meet him?
Oh, at the signing ceremony.
Oh, was really that a thrill?
Great. Oh, my glory, it was huge. And I thought that if I never did another important thing for people in poverty in our nation, that my life was filled. And
I would think that the church would have appreciated the fact that people would have health care. Why was it opposed to that letter?
Well, the problem was that the staff at the bishop's office in Washington, D.C. assigned all of healthcare policy to the anti-abortion office. And so the only lens through which they were looking at it was that abortion issue. And they liked the House bill better than the Senate bill. This is kind of detailed, wonky stuff. So they decided not to negotiate, not to be involved in lobbying the Senate bill because they wanted to promote the House bill. But then what happened was it was that Senate bill that ended up getting passed as the legislation. And so they were upset that they weren't in the negotiation, but they chose to sit it out. And they tried to say there was federal funding for abortion in the bill. There is not. Two federal courts have said that there is not. And the bill itself says there needs to be an audit every year to ensure that there isn't. And so we felt comfortable with what the law said. They didn't. So.
Sister Simone Campbell, how do you wrestle with the abortion issue yourself?
Well, I think that the issue has gotten so blown out of proportion because, you know, the issue is birth. And yes, I believe in the sanctity of life. I am pro-life, but it's so much more than just that issue. And I don't understand why that's the only issue that become the measure of how Catholic you are? Because while I support life, I also understand the challenges that women face, that women are more inclined to carry a baby to term if they have economic supports, if they have good childcare, if they have access to health care, if they have the family support that they need. And so my work has taken me much more to work on the supports for women, the ways that we can promote a real life as to, not real life, but I mean the whole family situation. How do we support families? And that in that context, then we support life. So I take a much broader view of it, but definitely I'm pro-life. I actually don't know anybody who's anti-life,
well,
quite frankly.
That. Yeah. That's why it was anti-abortion people did such a clever job framing it as
Amen.
Pro-life. Who can be anti-life?
But, exactly.
But what about this charge of radical feminism that came from Rome? I mean, that doesn't sound like a radical feminist analysis.
Do I sound like a radical feminist? The funny thing is when I was in law school in the 70s, late 70s, I was a radical feminist. I mean, I was, I read all the feminist literature, and I was really, a militant feminist. I discovered my power. It was all this. Now, I mean, it is amusing to think that who I am now is seen as a radical feminist. They didn't know me when I really was one. So.
Why is it so threatening to Rome, though?
Well, there's the $150,000 question. I think, I think a big piece of it is that they're just not used to having women who are educated, who have, we went to school because the Pope in the 1950s encouraged us to get education. So we get education. I mean, I'm a lawyer. I'm used to asking hard questions, disputation, engaging in dialogue. And, well, if you live in Rome, which is totally mostly just the men, you're not used to having those kinds of exchanges with women. So I guess they just don't have practice doing it.
Or a little threatened, perhaps.
Or a little threatened, perhaps. That could be, yes.
Do you see a day coming in the next decades or century when women would be ordained as priests?
Oh, glory. That is a really a good question. I don't know. What I do know is that we are discovering that there are many ways to minister within the church, and there are many ways to make Christ present. And what Jesus says in the gospel is that where two or three are gathered, I'm in your midst. And so I think one of the things that are happening is like nuns on the bus. I have met so many people who tell me they are not attending church now, and they may be Catholic, they may be all kinds of different faiths, but because of this work, they are feeling a new life, a new sense of hope, a new sense of connection. And for me, that becomes really a sacred event. And if I was ordained in the church I know, I'd probably be in a parish, and I'd never be a nun on the bus. So the Holy Spirit's alive and pushing us places we probably would never go. And I don't know. This is sacred. This is a sacred journey. And so I know good things are being done by it. I don't know where we'll end up on ordination and all this other stuff. I just know this is my road.
The person on this road is Sister Simone Campbell. She is one of the people who put that Nun on the Bus tour together. She was on the bus. And you may have seen her on TV or heard her on radio discussing it. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Sister Simone is the executive director of the Catholic Social Justice Lobby Network. She's speaking with me courtesy of the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice. Got a lot of friends in that group here in Madison, Wisconsin. You deal with poverty issues a lot in the United States. Describe the magnitude of that problem or the specificity of that problem.
Oh, it's horrifying. I mean, the fact is that right now people can work for full time and work at minimum wage, and they're living in poverty. I'm going to use this example in the talk I'm giving, but in Milwaukee, I met Billy and his wife at St. Benedict's Dining Room, and their two kids, and both he and his wife are working. They're making minimum wage, and they're in poverty. So they use food stamps to feed the kids during the day and go to St. Benedict's Dining Room at night so they can get a full meal. And one of their kids is a 14-year-old teenager, maybe 15 by now. But, in that teenage devour everything phase, and they just did not have enough to feed them. And what Billy told me was that they decided they only had enough money to either put a roof over their head or food on the table. Mm-hmm. They had been homeless earlier, a few years ago, and they didn't want to do it again because it wasn't good for the boys. They wanted to make sure the boys could stay in their same school. So they put all their money into having a roof over their head. I mean, it is shocking that in the richest nation on earth, people can work full-time and still be in poverty. That's wrong. Mm-hmm. That's wrong. The president in the State of the Union the State of the Union called for increase in minimum wage. Mm-hmm. He called for $9 an hour. But do you know that if we're going to have minimum wage have the same buying power it did in 1970, it has to be more than $12.50 an hour. That would get people out of poverty. The other piece that people miss, especially Congressman Ryan, is that those who are working for minimum wage in poverty need to use the social safety net just to feed their families. Mm-hmm. So we've made a choice as a nation not to increase minimum wage, but to have a safety net so workers can be fed. But what I realized was that Billy and his wife, they get a handout at St. Benedict's, they use food stamps, but it's also their employer that's benefiting because the employer has lower costs
right. And
has a fed worker. And then I realized, oh my glory, it's not only the employer, it's the consumer, because it keeps costs down. It keeps us, paying below what really market is needed. And so all of us benefit from this social safety net. Hmm. I don't think people see those connections. And that's one of the connections I'm trying to lift up so that people see we're in this together and that workers really need to be able to have a living wage so they can care for their family. Or we need a really strong safety net for everybody.
It is amazing how that safety net's been hacked at. And we have one out of every five children in this country lives in poverty. And that's just
a scandal in the richest nation on earth. And the other piece is I do this, well, I call it a human bar graph where you march out the change in income over the last 30 years. But by percentages and all this, it's a lot of detail. And since this isn't TV, we can't do it. But what happens is the top 1% income between 1979 and 2009 grew by 170%. So what happens is when you march that out, that person representing the top 1% ends up out the room, out of the room. And they can no longer see folks at the bottom. The lowest 20% in that same period, their income went down 7%. Hmm. Down 7%. It's outrageous. We need a way to bring everybody together, closer together, because when we're that far apart, then we don't know each other. Hmm. We don't know what's going on.
We've got about a minute left. How do you bring people closer together?
Well, Nuns on the Bus did a good job of kind of getting the conversation going. The other thing is, I think, is where we meet ordinary people. I have what I call my missionary work in the Safeway grocery store line, where I just talk to people. What's their experience? What do they have? And making sure that everyone knows that we're in this together. I benefit, you benefit. That's who we need to be. We the people.
You've been listening to Sister Simone Campbell, my guest today on Progressive Radio. She's the executive director of the Catholic Social Justice Lobby Network, which you can reach at networklobby.org. And Sister, it's been just a tremendous privilege of mine to finally get to meet you and sit down and talk with you. Thanks so much for being my guest.
Thanks for this opportunity. I've loved it. Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.